I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Talking about two of the most famous people of the 19th century, one who's still famous for us today, one who was famous in his time, might not be as well known today, but he is certainly very important for understanding American history and the course of the American Civil War. We're talking today about John C. Fremont and Abraham Lincoln and their relationship. We're talking about that with our guest today, John Bicknell. John is a writer and retired journalist who spent 3 decades in the journalism business. He's also has been the co-editor of the Politics in America and senior editor of the Almanac of American Politics. So this is a person who has had a chance to study very deeply American political history, particularly of the 19th century. And that shows in his three of his terrific books, which I want to heartily recommend to our listeners. One is called America 1844. The other is called Lincoln's Pathfinder, John C. Fremont and the Violent Election of 1856. And then our subject of conversation for today, his book entitled The Pathfinder and the President, John C. Fremont, Abraham Lincoln, and the Battle for Emancipation. I got to just tell our listeners, these are wonderful books. They have the flair of a journalist who really knows how to tell a great story. So let me recommend them to you. John Bicknell, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thanks for having me.
I think, of course, our listeners are pretty historically informed people, and just as American citizens, they know who Abraham Lincoln was. We've probably heard, most of us, about John C. Fremont, but refresh our minds a little bit. Who was Fremont?
Fremont was one of the most famous people, as you noted, in America in the 1850s, 1840s. He was an explorer, part of the Army Corps of Topographical Engineers that explored the American West. He wrote best-selling reports of those journeys, helped by his wife, Thomas Hart Benton's daughter, Jessie Benton Fremont. And people immigrating to Oregon and California used those guides to find their way west and to understand the land and to understand the topography. And Fremont really changed the way Americans viewed the West. From the idea of the great American desert, really to this great, beautiful land of opportunity, an idea that largely originated with Fremont.
Fremont, of course, it comes into play in your book in his relationship with Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War. But what about Fremont after he becomes famous as the Pathfinder, as you call him, and as he was called then, but before the Civil War, so in the 1850s, what's happening with John C. Fremont?
Fremont bought some land near what is now Yosemite National Park in California, and gold was discovered on it. So he became very rich without doing very much to become rich. He was elected to the Senate when California became a state, served briefly, drew the short straw, served the short term, didn't really accomplish much. Concentrated on the mining operation through the early 1850s. In 1855, both parties approached Fremont to be a potential candidate for president. The brand new Republican Party, just founded in 1854, on the basis of stopping the expansion of slavery into the Western territories. But the Democrats were also interested in Fremont. He'd been elected in 1850 as a Democrat. Fremont chose to go with the Republicans. He was the Republican nominee in 1856. Abraham Lincoln was considered to be a vice presidential candidate that year. He got the second most votes for vice president at the Republican convention. Did not get the job, obviously. Fremont lost the election, but what he did was two things. The Republican campaign that year was really almost an evangelical event. The first time that a major party had opposed slavery in any serious way. And he also showed that the right candidate could win the presidency by winning only northern states. Fremont lost New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Indiana, and Illinois, I think. But had he won even two of those, he would have been elected. So even with a third party candidate, Millard Fillmore, in the race. So what the Republicans needed was better organization in those states and a better candidate. Fremont was not really much of a politician. He liked to be out in the mountains. He did not operate well in civilization.
Well, how did he come by, since he was an explorer and, as you say, a reluctant politician, not necessarily a person who has been engaged in public life all his career? How did he come by his anti-slavery sentiments?
It's a good question. He evolved on the issue. He was born in Savannah, Georgia, and largely raised in Charleston, went to college in Charleston. He married Belle. He married Jesse Benton, as I mentioned, the daughter of Thomas R. Benton, who was a longtime senator from Missouri, who was a slave owner for a while, but opposed the expansion of slavery into new territories. And that cost him his Senate seat. So Fremont sort of came by it naturally as he moved into the greater culture out of Georgia and South Carolina. In the Senate, he opposed, he voted for the abolition of the slave trade in the District of Columbia, but he opposed abolition of slavery in the District of Columbia. So he didn't have this long record of opposition to slavery, but he decided really in 1855 and 1856 that that's where he was headed as a public figure, and that's why he chose the Republican Party over the Democratic Party.
So between 1856 and 1860, obviously, you say, already there's a kind of relationship, a nascent relationship between Fremont and Lincoln, if Lincoln was considered for a vice presidential position. What's happening in Republican Party politics and between Fremont and Lincoln between 1856 and then when Lincoln becomes candidate for president in 1860?
Right. As far as I could determine, they actually never met before 1861. Lincoln campaigned for Fremont extensively in 1856, and mostly in Illinois. He made one trip to Michigan, but I don't think they ever met. Of course, that period, 56 to 60, was pretty active in terms of revolutionary events. The Dred Scott decision, Buchanan's betrayal of Free Kansas, where Stephen Douglas broke with him. And then, of course, the John Brown raid on Harper's Ferry sort of changed the atmosphere of the North from being less worried about secession and more worried about where the South was taking the country. Those events, plus Lincoln was just a so much better politician than Fremont, better candidate, better man, and a better organized, just the party had grown and organized itself much more effectively in those 4 years, made it more likely that Lincoln would be elected. And then, of course, the Democratic Party fell apart, which made it almost certain that Lincoln would be elected.
So then when Lincoln becomes elected, is Fremont immediately part of the administration? Is he immediately part of the army? Or is there some time that has to develop in the relationship between them?
Fremont is actually in Europe for a lot of that early period. He met with Lincoln in New York in February of 1861 as Lincoln was on his way to Washington. Fremont was on his way to Europe. He was going to France and England to try to find investors for his mining operations. He didn't find any, but what he found was when the war started in April, he was still in Europe. He began buying weapons, some with his own money, some trying to get the ambassadors, the ministers to those countries from the United States to help him. had no official sanction. It was just sort of the kind of spur of the moment, off the cuff thing Fremont was doing all the time. But in May, Lincoln submitted Fremont's name to the Senate as a major general. He was extremely popular still, had a huge constituency in the Republican Party. And of course, he had some military experience. He didn't have much military experience. He'd never led more than 300 or 400 men in battle in California during the Mexican War. But he had this reputation as a great military leader. His fame preceded him. And the expectations for Fremont as a military leader were sky high. He was the second ranking general in the Army beneath Winfield Scott, who was the major general. McClellan was the senior major general, and then Fremont was next.
So obviously, he's, as you say, he was a famous person in his time. He's appointed general right away. The subtitle of your book is John C. Fremont, Abraham Lincoln, and the Battle for Emancipation. What is the battle that happens between Fremont and Lincoln over emancipation?
Fremont was named head of the Department of the West, headquartered in St. Louis, responsible for Missouri, but also for most of the land from Missouri to the Rocky Mountains, up to Canada and down to Texas. So it was a huge swath of territory, but most of the effort there was focused on Missouri in the first few months of the war. Fremont got there in July of 1861, and within a month, he had come to the conclusion that it was a hopeless case, that Missouri was lawless. There were too many Confederate sympathizers. Slavery, of course, Missouri was a slave state. And so he declared martial law across Missouri on August 30th, usurping the authority of the pro-Union, but also pro-slavery governor, Hamilton Gamble, and also emancipated the slaves of Missouri, issued an order that freed the slaves in Missouri. He didn't talk to Lincoln about it. He didn't talk to Gamble about it. He didn't even talk to his wife about it. And he talked to her about almost everything. He just issued the order. Almost immediately.
Can I just say that is surprising to me because, you know, as you said before, when he was a senator from California, he opposed the expansion of slavery, but he voted to abolish the slave trade, but not abolish slavery itself.
Right.
Had he become a more ardent abolitionist, or was there something else going on in his thinking for him to act so almost precipitously?
Fremont was known for acting precipitously on a number of things, but I think really what happened was he saw what was happening in the war, and he came to the conclusion that slavery was the underpinning of the Confederate war effort, especially in Missouri, but everywhere, and that to effectively strike at the rebels, he needed to deprive them of this asset. A couple of months earlier, some slaves in Virginia had moved into the lines of General Benjamin Butler, another politician general, and Butler had refused to return them, inventing the term contraband of war. This was happening in Missouri, too. Grant wrote a letter to headquarters the same day or the day before that Fremont issued the order saying, I've got all these escaped slaves coming into my lines. What do I do with them? So it was already an issue. The moment Union armies moved into the South, the process of emancipation began.
Can you talk a little bit more? You mentioned the situation in Missouri. I know it's not history, but I think, for example, of the Clint Eastwood movie, The Outlaw Josie Wales, which has a portrayal of kind of the craziness of Missouri in the Civil War, where it's a Union state, but it's pro-slavery. You have pro-Union folks, you have anti-Union folks, you have people in the middle, and there's almost like a guerrilla war, it seems like, going on. What's the situation in Missouri that Fremont confronts?
That was part of his motivation. It was entirely lawless. There were neighbors killing neighbors, stealing their property, and it got worse and worse. Fremont left Missouri in November of 1861, but the situation didn't really improve until the end of the war. And actually, you could argue it didn't improve after the war either, because that's sort of part of the lawlessness that you're talking about, the ex-Confederates who then turned into into just complete bandits. But Missouri, there were, I believe, more battles fought in Missouri than in any state other than Virginia.
Wow. So it really was a Western front of the war, even if it was a guerrilla sort of front.
Yeah. And most of those battles were quite small. Battle of Wilson's Creek, which was fought on August 10th, 1861, was the second sort of major battle of the war after Manassas. But it only involved something like 25,000 troops. So it was relatively small in the scheme of things. It was also the first invasion of the North, really, by the Confederates, if you consider Missouri part of the North. So it was a very unhappy situation, very difficult to deal with for anyone. The people who succeeded Fremont didn't have much more success than he did. And so he was faced with this violent atmosphere, and he believed the solution of that was martial law and to strike a blow at slavery.
All right. So let's talk about that, the proclamation itself. What does he proclaim after he's proclaimed martial law? What does he proclaim with respect to slaves? For example, are they all immediately emancipated? What is the situation? And then how is that proclamation received in Missouri?
He declared all the slaves in the state free. He had no real mechanism for enforcing this. He was in the proclamation, he was going to leave it up to civil authorities who had no method of enforcing it, and half of whom at least would have opposed it. As I said, he didn't inform anyone. So within a few days, Lincoln responded by telling him he needed to address the problems with this order. Lincoln didn't object to the martial law proclamation, but he did object to Fremont's order that anyone suspected of spying for the Confederacy be shot on sight, essentially, without trial. So Lincoln overrode that. And he also overrode, or he asked Fremont to, on his own volition, to retract the emancipation order. Fremont responded by saying, "I'm not going to do it. I've considered it deeply. I think it's the right thing to do. It's based on military necessity." That's sort of the key point, is that Fremont based this on military necessity, not on the First Confiscation Act, which had just been passed in August, which allowed for the emancipation of some slaves who were doing very specific things for the Confederate Army. And so when Fremont refused to do it on his own power, Lincoln rescinded the order on his own.
So in that meantime, what was the effect, if any, or the reception of his abolition proclamation in the North, and maybe even particularly among abolitionists? Did they know of this? Did they have a reaction to it?
Yeah, the abolitionists were extremely happy. This really was the moment when Fremont became sort of the emblem, the military symbol of emancipation, which he remained throughout the war. He was the signal figure of emancipation in the Federal Army, much more so than any other general until till the war was almost over. So they were very happy. Of course, Democrats in the North didn't like it. And there were people who were anti-slavery, but not strong, but were more pro-Union. And this is sort of where Lincoln found himself. He's obviously anti-slavery, but he was worried first about winning the war, preserving the Union. So with objections from close allies in, focus on Kentucky, because that was sort of the crux of the matter for Lincoln. Joshua Speed, good friend of Lincoln's, Robert Anderson, who was the hero of Fort Sumter, was also a Kentuckian. Joseph Holt, sort of an unofficial advisor to Lincoln, who had been in the Buchanan administration and might have been in the Lincoln administration. All wrote to Lincoln saying, "You've got to undo this. Kentucky will leave the Union. There'll be a revolution here if you don't." And Lincoln listened to that advice and overrode Fremont. I can talk about this a lot in the book. I think they were panic-stricken and overreacted. I don't think there's any indication that Kentucky would have ever left the Union. But Lincoln didn't know that. So he acted what he believed was prudently, and he wasn't ready yet to take that step.
Yeah, there is this quote that's at least attributed to Lincoln. I hope to have God on my side, but I must have Kentucky.
Right.
So he's worried, right, if the spillover effect in another border state, worried about Missouri, but as you say, particularly worried about Kentucky and perhaps some of the other border states. Do we know from newspapers or anything else at the time what the broader public reaction was to Fremont's proclamation? Was there, for example, that people said, wait, now it's an abolition war, what's going on? Or did people say, that makes sense?
Both. It depended on your point of view. There were a lot of people who were overjoyed with the proclamation, and there were other people who were not, who opposed it, who believed, as Lincoln did, that it would put the success of the war and the reunification of the country at risk. So there were, and as Lincoln said later, as I think, you know, there are people who'd be moved by this in one way and people who would be moved by it in the other way. So there's really nothing to be gained by doing this sort of thing right now. He held it in his pocket. Obviously, when he got around to writing his own Emancipation Proclamation, he used Fremont's own reasoning. He cited military necessity as the reason for freeing the slaves. So on January 1st, 1863, when Lincoln freed the slaves, he basically used Fremont's argument.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting in your book, one of the things you talk about is this kind of perhaps not as well known influence that Fremont had on Lincoln's thinking about emancipation and the way, for example, as you just said, that he wrote the Emancipation Proclamation. Do you have a sense of the relationship between the two men? Obviously, Lincoln asks him to withdraw the proclamation. He says no. Then Lincoln orders him to. Presumably, he obeys that order and rescinds it. What's their relationship like after that?
Yeah, it was not close. Lincoln was always a little wary of Fremont, with good reason. Fremont rescinded the order, but he also, at the same time, had additional copies of the proclamation printed and distributed. Around the state. Lincoln didn't know this at the time. And when he found out, that was really sort of the last nail in the coffin for Fremont. Lincoln gave Fremont a lot of leeway in terms of letting him march his army across the state to fight a battle. Lincoln really wanted to relieve Fremont from command as early as the end of September. Fremont had ordered the arrest of Frank Blair, a congressman, son of the Francis Preston Blair, close ally of Lincoln, as was Frank. He released him. Then Frank Blair refused to follow some orders, and Fremont had him arrested again. Lincoln had him released. And it was really the loss of the patronage of the Blair family that really cost Fremont his job. It was not emancipation. Emancipation hurt. It revealed to Lincoln that Fremont was kind of a loose cannon. But he also lost the patronage of the Blairs, and he wasn't doing anything militarily to improve the situation in Missouri. He chased the Confederates and the Confederate loyal State Guard out of the state, but he never fought a battle. That battle had to be fought the next year in February or in March of 1862 in Pea Ridge in Arkansas. But Fremont was long gone by then. So Fremont, oh, go ahead.
No. I was just going to say that's so interesting. The Civil War, you point this out in your book in a really insightful way, I thought, that the Civil War is so unlike many other wars America has fought, in the sense that while you're trying to wage war, as Fremont was in Missouri, you have to think about it's a civil war. It's not a war against an enemy exactly, an alien enemy at least. And you have to fight it in such a way, certainly Lincoln thought, that in the end there has to be able to be reconciliation between the two parties that have been war. It's not just going to be we defeat them and then we salt the earth and destroy our enemy. So did Fremont grasp that complexity of the situation as he was waging war?
Yes, I think he did, but I think he had a different viewpoint of it than Lincoln did. I think Fremont started out where Lincoln started, as in, let's bloody their nose, they'll come to their senses, this will all be over. A month in Missouri showed Fremont that wasn't going to work. It turns out Fremont was right and Lincoln was wrong. Now, the difference, I think, is that after a year, it took Fremont a month to decide this. It took Lincoln a little over a year. But Lincoln got there. He realized by the middle of 1862 that soft war was not going to get the job done. And that's when he began taking the steps that he took toward emancipation.
And then Lincoln's relationship with Fremont, as you say, became strained after this incident, after Fremont lost the patronage of the important Blair family in Missouri. What then happens to the relationship between Fremont and Lincoln through the rest of the course of the war?
Right. Fremont was relieved of command in late October, early November of 1861. He went home to, he was living in New York at the time, and essentially started campaigning both publicly and privately for another command. Lincoln was somewhat reluctant to do this based on what he'd already experienced with Fremont, but he also needed to placate that wing of the party. And so his solution was to give Fremont a command that wasn't viewed as very, you know, particularly important, the Mountain Department in Western Virginia. Fremont took that over in March of 1862. And again, sort of failed spectacularly, wasn't effective in the field, had all kinds of good reasons / excuses for why that was the case. But the bottom line was he didn't get the job done. And part of it was Fremont's incompetence, but part of it was Lincoln and Stanton were trying to run that war from Washington. They didn't have a unified command. They had three generals. Fremont, McDowell, and Banks, that they were sort of trying to command and move around in Virginia, and it just wasn't working. Nobody could react fast enough. They were confronting Stonewall Jackson, famous for moving fast. And so in June, Lincoln does what he probably should have done in February or March, which was appoint somebody, put somebody in charge of the whole thing, which was John Pope. Pope had served under Fremont in Missouri. He had been insubordinate in Missouri, and Fremont didn't like him. Also, Fremont was senior to Pope in the service. So when Pope was appointed commander over Fremont, Fremont asked to be relieved, and he was. And the war was over for him in June of 1862. That was the last conflict, at least military conflict, that Fremont saw in the war.
One of the things that your book reflects on, and I thought very interestingly, is the important qualities of leadership that we see in Fremont and in Lincoln And some of the defects of leadership that you've mentioned already. From your study of Fremont and Lincoln, particularly of Fremont, what important qualities of leadership did you see that he had and that he needed to have but didn't?
There's a quote about Fremont that I think encapsulates him perfectly. He had all the capabilities, all the abilities of genius. He had all the attributes of genius except ability. That he was intelligent, he was charismatic, he was energetic, he was a risk taker, an incredible risk taker. But whatever that thing is that lets people be a wise and judicious person, he didn't have it. Fremont was great away from civilization in the Rocky Mountains, on the prairies, crossing the Sierra Nevada in the dead of winter. Now, even in these situations, he got people killed and acted recklessly. But he always managed to come out looking like a winner. But that was when he was away from authority and could act on his own. He benefited from patronage of powerful men, Benton and others, who sort of helped him out of a few scrapes. But he was not very good as part of a team or as an order taker. That really, you know, that's when you're in the military and you're below the president, your job is to take orders, even if you're the number three general in the Army. And he just couldn't sustain that for any long period of time. Lincoln was a completely different kind of person. I mean, he was a lawyerly person. He thought things through. He had a bedrock belief in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. His belief in anti-slavery came from that foundation. Fremont just sort of came. Fremont's principles served Fremont's ends, and Lincoln's principles served the Constitution. And that really was the difference between the two men. And it's not that Fremont was some bad guy and Lincoln was the good guy. It's just that they had very different approaches to the way you solved problems. And the president's always going to win that argument.
What about personally? What kind of a man was John C. Fremont? I think we have some ideas you suggest of Abraham Lincoln personally. Was Fremont, you mentioned he was intelligent, he was charismatic. What was he like to be around, whether he was an adventurer, whether he was the pathfinder, or whether he was a general?
People liked being around Fremont. He was not a backslapper, and he was quiet, sort of a reticent person. But he was a popular figure among his group. He never was able to sort of break out of that. There were people who were wary of Fremont remained wary of Fremont their entire lives. People who liked him, there was a general that Lincoln sent that said, you know, Fremont has all these great qualities, and he starts talking to you, and you just hang on every word, you believe it. And yet, you know, there's just something about the "and yet" that raises a question. And he had dubious dealings in Missouri. He granted contracts to friends and allies. Not everybody did this, but Fremont's friends and allies weren't part of this other group. Fremont was sort of excluded from the West Point pipeline because he wasn't a West Pointer. The regular Army really resented him because of favoritism shown to him in the past. He was a terrible businessman. He got this great fortune essentially handed to him and blew it all, lost it all, never really recovered. So there was always this sort of air of dubiousness about Fremont's activities that clung to him all the way, all through his life.
What about after 1862 and he's relieved? What happens to John C. Fremont over the rest of the course of his time?
Fremont had a chance to get back in the war after much cajoling. Lincoln agreed to appoint Fremont to command some black troops in 1863, in the summer of 1863. They had been talk of making him military governor of North Carolina, but Lincoln didn't want to do that. So when Lincoln agreed, through extensive negotiations that involved Charles Sumner, to get Fremont this posting, Fremont then says, no, I'm not interested. I don't think it would work. I don't hold the president's confidence, which is probably true. And so that went by the wayside. And after that, Fremont turned back to politics, and he was a third party candidate for president in 1864, opposing Lincoln largely on Reconstruction policy, not so much abolition. By that time, Lincoln had, or, you know, issued the Emancipation Proclamation, was supporting the 13th Amendment. So this comes back to sort of the harsh war versus soft war. Fremont saw a much harsher post-war life for the South than Lincoln did.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. So then for the rest of his public career, did he kind of fall in with the radical Republicans?
Actually, after he withdrew from the 1864 campaign in September, fearing because he feared that it might cost Lincoln the election. He was still no fan of Lincoln, but he didn't want McClellan to be elected. And that was the end of his essentially public career. He returned to business. He had lost some money during the war. He lost the rest of it by 1873, in the Panic of 1873. He and Jesse were broke. They weren't broke. That's an exaggeration. They had considerable illiquid assets, and they began selling them to live off of. She wrote books and articles to support them. As a favor, President Hayes appointed Fremont governor of Arizona Territory in 1877 or 78, I think, where he served for 3 years, didn't really accomplish much. And that was pretty much the end. He lived his last decade of life in, you know, sort of obscurity, if you can imagine how famous he was only a few decades earlier. He had lost much of his luster during the war. He lost all his riches, and he died not exactly penniless, but his wife was in California and he was in New York, and it was kind of a sad ending for him.
Well, it is, however, a fascinating story and wonderfully told in this book by John Bicknell. Let me again recommend it to our listeners. It's called The Pathfinder and the President, John C. Fremont, Abraham Lincoln, and the Battle for Emancipation. John, thanks for being with us today on The American Idea.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.